ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
As America marks 250 years of independence from Britain, join me, Nick Bryant, for an exploration of the country's origin story and what's happened since.
This is the beginning of the time when human beings were no longer subjects, but citizens.
From the Declaration of Independence to the presidency of Donald Trump, join me for our America 250 series on Saturday Extra. Search for Saturday Extra on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. Epidemics are always good for a headline. Ebola in the Congo, measles in South Carolina. What we don't hear about, but will a little later, are the epidemics averted by shrewd intervention, crucial to the task, money and suspicion. Later, the invisible triumph of epidemics that never happen. But first, in late 1986, Paul Keating changed Australia at a stroke by allowing Rupert Murdoch to buy the old Herald and Weekly Times empire, delivering to one man two-thirds of the newspapers published every day in Australia. From that time, what Murdoch wants has been a matter of serious, at times vital, concern, and not just to the nation's politicians, because for 40 years, this man has had the loudest voice in Australia. How he gets his way here in Britain and America is the subject of a new book by two journalists who've worked for Murdoch, amongst others, and are now professors of the trade, Andrew Dodd at Melbourne and Matthew Ricketson at Deakin University. They've called their book Getting Murdoched: How Murdoch's Media Wields Power and Punishment. And here's a clue to their argument. The book is dedicated to the bullied. Andrew, welcome back to the ABC.
Thank you very much, David. It's lovely to be here.
And Matthew, welcome to you once again.
Thank you, David. Likewise.
Now, first of all, Murdoch is a genius, right? You say in the book that the Fox network is the single most profitable news media business in the world. What is this man's genius?
Well, yes, we have given him that accolade in a sense. We do have to give him credit. He certainly is a master of this business of media. He has built a global empire. You've got to give him some credit for it. It's what he's done with that empire, really, that is the subject of this book.
But Matthew, bullying media proprietors are as old as the printing press, are they not? I mean, isn't this man just Beaverbrook down under?
No, I don't think so. Because yes, there have been bullies in the media for since time immemorial, or since the rise of the daily newspaper. What's different about Murdoch is a couple of things, I think. First, he was the first to create a global media empire. I mean, Lord Beaverbrook was primarily working in the United Kingdom, and the second is that he's been doing it for seven decades plus. Most of the people you've referred to kind of, pegged out well within that kind of term. So the kind of the footprint of Murdoch across the globe, it's been running, as you said in your introduction, since at least the 1980s. And that's not the beginning of it. The beginning of it is back in Adelaide in the early 1950s.
But those techniques seem essentially familiar to me from reading about Beaverbrook. And perhaps we should go to them straight mm-hmm. away. The principal technique he uses to get his way, you argue, is the sustained barrage of criticism, or as one of his victims called it, a torrential downpour of hate. Now, is that not familiar from the history of newspapers?
It, of course, it is familiar, but as I said, I think it's both longer lasting and broader, and you're starting to see the effects of that breadth in the sense that I don't think I'd be the first person on your program to have commented recently that the world is a very volatile and unhappy and divided place at the moment. And one of the things that we're arguing in the book is that Rupert Murdoch has been a key driver of that. He and his media outlets, not by only mean, by any means the only driver, but definitely one of them. And Fox News is one of the key kind of bows in his armory, and has changed the way in which television is done in the United States, and not for the better. It's kind of dragged most of the rest of the broadcast media down with him, so that really the Fox News network, and we only have to look at the Dominion lawsuit a couple of years ago and the evidence that came out of, from that through the discovery process, that network has been in the business of propaganda, not journalism, for quite some time now.
And you'll have to wait, David, for our sequel, the Getting Beaverbrooked series.
I think Ann Chisholm has written that book, and it was bloody good. Mm. But Andrew, Matthew spoke a moment ago about division, sowing division. I want to lob an idea at both of you, and that is that what Murdoch sells is something most of us love, which is certainty. The division comes, that comes down the track, but what he's selling is absolute certainty about an issue.
Well, that's a very interesting idea. I don't know whether I agree with it. I think what he is mostly selling is opposition. He's mostly selling, in my mind, this idea that you can rail against those who are preaching an orthodoxy. So it's the shibboleths of woke culture or of progressive left ideas. Here, what he's giving mostly is people a way to think outside that paradigm. And he's found an audience, not just with willing listeners and viewers, but I think really, unfortunately, with advertisers as well. He found that that pays. And that has come really to the detriment of civil discussion and discourse.
You mentioned a moment ago the Dominion defamation suit in the United States. Mm. Now, Dominion make voting machines, and Fox attacked those voting machines as having been rigged in the 2020 elections.
Yes.
What we discovered in the course of that litigation was Rupert Murdoch's view of the 2020 elections. What does Rupert Murdoch think happened in 2020?
Rupert Murdoch thinks that the Donald Trump lost that election. I mean, he thinks in a sense what anyone with, you know, two eyes and ears and all the rest of it would think. That is that the election was lost to Joe Biden, that it wasn't rigged. And the really important point at that moment is that as Fox as a network and its producers and executives begin to see post the election and with Donald Trump's, you know, braying about how it was rigged and he was robbed and so on, they start to see that the audience for Fox starts drifting away from them across even further to the right to outlets such as Newsmax. And they make a decision, a conscious decision, to alter their news breaking stance on this issue and start to accommodate this conspiracy theory, baseless conspiracy theory, that the election was rigged. So if you remember, on the night of the election, Fox's news desk actually was the first to call the critical seat in the election, which tipped over the numbers to give Joe Biden the presidency. So they did their job that night, you know, and after that, when they saw what was happening to their audience, they went with their audience. And that's when, in our view, they move away from being in the business of journalism to being in the business of propaganda. And now they're kind of trapped by that audience in the sense that they, whatever their audience wants, they give it to them, and they won't ever give them contrary or unsettling or uncomfortable information.
Andrew, another way of putting that might be to say that Murdoch went with the money.
He did, and described Trump's claims about election fraud as bullshit and damaging. And what's more, his presenters knew. Tucker Carlson knew, Laura Ingraham knew, Sean Hannity knew. They all knew, and we know that because of the Dominion discovery documents. And you're absolutely right. He chased the money. He had to get that audience back. They'd gone to the Newsmax network and they'd found that they were losing up to about 20% of their audience. And then at that point, it was a desperate search to get them back, to say anything that they needed to do anything, say anything that they needed to bring that audience back to the fold.
on ABC Radio National. This is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Andrew Dodd and Matthew Ricketson about their new book, Getting Murdoch'd. Now, you two, I was determined to keep this conversation focused on Australia. It's impossible, of course, isn't it? But let's get back to Australia, and let's talk about those techniques that the Murdoch press uses in order to get its way. And I mentioned earlier the sustained barrage. And in my lifetime of looking at newspapers, I don't think I've seen one as sustained as the barrage against Brittany Higgins, raped, according to the civil courts, in Linda Reynolds' office. Matthew, would you put it up? Would you rate it as exceptional?
Yes. Among a pretty grisly cast, yes. It is. I mean, we are talking about, a serious sexual assault claim that was originally made by Brittany Higgins. We know it's a very complicated case and has gone in all sorts of different directions. One of the things that we wanted to do was to focus on the way in which News Corp Australia, and in particular The Australian, and in particular one of its longtime columnists, Janet Albrechtsen, had dealt with this as an issue. It was and what we found, I mean, in a period of about 2.5 years beginning in late 2021, she wrote 123 articles about the Brittany Higgins case. And she's written more subsequently, but our kind of count, if you like, pegged out in the middle of 2024 after Justice Michael Lee had found in the federal court that on the balance of probabilities in a civil trial, Brittany Higgins had been raped by Bruce Lerman. So I think the key thing that we found was, okay, it's 123 articles. We're not talking about in briefs here. We're talking about columns, features, front page news exclusives in the Weekend Australian, which is, you know, its highest selling or newspaper of the week. And, well, the way in which, as far as we can see from looking at all of these articles, the way in which Janet Albrechtsen operates is not as a journalist as such, that is investigating an issue, looking at a range of different perspectives and then coming to a kind of considered conclusion. She operates more like a barrister who has a brief, and the brief is to argue the client's side of the case. I mean, that the legal system is set up in that way for good reason, the adversarial system. The question here is it appropriate for journalism, especially when, for a start, it's a really complicated case. For a second, it's a really sensitive, personal case for Brittany Higgins and those around her. And third, it ignores the slew of other kind of competing issues and complications and so on. And what you end up with is this picture of Brittany Higgins, a questioning of her claims to begin with, and then a piling on of any particular aspect of what she has done and said over the past 3 or 4 years that is open to question or is wrong.
But Matthew, this is a big story.
Yes.
It raises enormously important issues. It crosses into the world of politics, the world of law. Yes, she's written an astonishing number of articles. Have you read them? Are you able to say do you think they are fair?
I had the job of reading those, and I wouldn't say that they're fair at all. I think Matthew's description of her acting like a barrister is right, because they're necessarily one-sided. So, you know, she does this under the pretext of pushing for a fair trial for one person, but in the process, she is deeply critical of every aspect of the other person's side. So Higgins has been described as a woman who takes no prisoners. Others were criticised for apologising to her and for the compensation she was paid, because in Albrechtsen's mind, that would undermine a fair trial of Lerman, and so on and so on. Almost every aspect of the case over that 2.5 year period is criticised, where she accentuates Lerman's case at the expense of Brittany Higgins.
There's another technique that the pair of you have identified in the book, and that is to find the howler, to find the mistake made in an argument that you disapprove of. Now, we're not talking about Janet Ulrichsen necessarily now. We're talking about a range of commentators in News Limited papers, yes, and things. What's wrong with identifying mistakes? I mean, that's important.
Of course it is. Of course it is. And we have found that's one of the most, I think, pervasive and in some ways insidious techniques, where you take something, or where news and its journalists take something that is a legitimate mistake or a legitimate or an ill-advised comment or an error of judgment. Okay, that's, you know, task one, yes, identify that. Where it falls down is that the work doesn't stop there on the part of the News Corp journalists. They keep both identifying and then lambasting and criticising and jumping on the head of that particular person and their mistake, long after the person may have either apologised or acknowledged they've made a mistake. And so there's a disproportionality that happens, which means that you get a completely distorted view of that particular person and whatever it is they've done. So, I mean, one of the people we've interviewed in the book is Larissa Berendt, and your listeners may remember she made an ill-advised tweet back in about 2011 when Q&A, the program on the ABC, was running, and there was a debate on the program about the Northern Territory intervention, and she made some ill-advised tweet, which was picked up the next day in The Australian, front page story, legitimate story. What wasn't legitimate was the kind of next 15 or 16 stories with opinion columns and editorials and so on that just jumped on her again and again, even though she had apologised almost immediately for what she had done.
What you're arguing, as I take it, is that it's the excessive response, the out of proportion response to, yes, mistakes of this kind.
Absolutely. The disproportionality of the response. I mean, 16 articles after somebody has apologised for an errant tweet that they knew was wrong, they even apologised to the person about whom the tweet was written. And the way in which that apology was offered by Larissa Berendt was weaponized by The Australian against her. So what happens by about day 3 or 4 or 5 of one of these attacks is that the paper starts to get very imaginative about what gets included in this sort of barrage of negativity that rains down on someone. And so, but by the end of it, you're just completely discombobulated. You can't do anything right in the eyes of the Australian newspaper when they're coming for you. They will use absolutely anything they can against you.
Which undermines the idea, David, the entirely legitimate idea of identifying a mistake that someone might have made. It goes well beyond that, and I would argue, has the effect of undermining that original legitimate aim.
You also point out that there's a long record in the Murdoch press of being extraordinarily thin-skinned when it comes to criticism of its own operations.
Yeah, part of the process of writing this book, and another one that Matthew and I have worked on, is occasionally ringing News Corp editors and putting to them, or giving to them, the right of reply they so often don't give to others. And it's a kind of extreme sport when you do it, because you ring them up and you say, we are now going to publish X and Y about you and your, you know, management or editorial control of the publication. And then what you do is you hold the phone about a foot away from your ear and count to 3. And by about the time you get to 3, they'll start screaming at you about all the ways in which you can't publish this thing that you want to write about them. And the process of negotiation about what we can write and whether or not we've got it right and verifying begins. But what I've found working at the Oz, and what I've found reading various News Corp outlets and publications, is that they are remarkably thin-skinned about criticism, even though they're so good at dishing it out. And for me, that is kind of inexplicable and unforgivable.
You, Matthew, you write about the quarterly essay that Robert Mann, public intellectual, that Robert Mann wrote in 2011 about The Australian. Now, what was the repercussions for him?
Well, the repercussions of that were thousands and thousands of words, more than the original quarterly essay itself, lambasting him, you know, to be frank, shitbagging him. And I don't use the word lightly in the sense that there was a cartoon that was done with Robert Mann sitting on a toilet, and the caption was "Man made emissions," you know. So, but that was one particularly kind of weird example of this torrent of abuse and negativity that rained down on Robert Mann after writing a quarterly essay, which is still worth reading, called "Bad News About the Australian as a Newspaper and its both its strengths and its weaknesses," and at virtually at no stage, I mean, amid the torrent of words, I think two minor errors were identified in the quarterly essay, and I mean minor, but in a sense they went well past that, and they just literally poured bucket after bucket after bucket of abuse on top of him in a kind of frenzy, really. So, you know, Robert Mann is, as you say, a distinguished public intellectual. I mean, he has written about this experience and how weird it was and how thin-skinned the newspaper was and how, in a sense, the more they said, the more they made his case in the quarterly essay that this is a newspaper that, for all its strengths, has got some significant weaknesses and is having a negative impact on the overall national kind of discourse. And it is our national daily newspaper.
But, Andrew, these tantrums, do they work? I mean, what's the impact of them?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've asked myself that a lot too. And I think sometimes these tantrums are about generating heat for their own sake. It's about the creation of column inches, because after all, these publications are in the business of producing content, and this serves their idea of what constitutes content. So part of it is just keeping the heat going and enjoying the sort of mayhem they're creating. It certainly works on undermining the confidence of some of those that they attack. We've found that some of those people who have withstood these terrible assaults have been impacted personally quite deeply, while others are quite unaffected by them. But I think how they affect public discourse and public debate is that they generally over time chip away at people's reputations so that they become controversial. And then they can label them quite legitimately as controversial, even though they are the people who made them controversial by undermining them through this, you know, process of chipping away at them. And then when you undermine somebody's credibility, they have less authority in a debate, and therefore it serves their side of the argument to have created this kind of aura or this this kind of sense of this person being controversial. It helps them win the argument.
But Matthew, who's reading this stuff? I mean, if you're opening the paper and there's the 84th article by Janet Albrightson about Brittany Higgins, or the 612th column by Gerard Henderson attacking the ABC. I mean, is anybody actually reading it?
Well, look, who knows? We haven't. No one, to the best of my knowledge, has done that academic study. But I think intuitively, my answer would be that most people aren't reading all of those articles. I think they see the headline, they see the illustration, they see maybe the editorial or the cartoon. They pick up the tone of the newspaper towards this person or that person, and they don't read. I don't think they read every single word. But that to go to Andrew's point, that's not their point. That's not news's point. They are in the business of persuading you to a particular view, and they do that not least by continuing to bludgeon you with it time and time and time again.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Andrew Dodd and Matthew Ricketson about their book, Getting Murdoch'd. Andrew, there was a time when Murdoch could make and break governments, but do you think he can now? I'm talking about Australia. Let's concentrate on the home field. Do you think he can now? I've frequently argued, look, you know, they've been trying to get rid of the Lord Mayor of Sydney now for about 12 years, and she's still there.
Yeah. It's a good question. They obviously have less impact now than they once had, but they still have an outsized amount of impact and influence. They set agendas. They affect the rundowns of other publications and the editorial output of other organisations. So they're affecting the news cycle and what
including at the ABC.
Yeah.
I would say.
On a daily basis, I would have thought. So they are still very influential, and they will sometimes have the effect of beginning a cascade that is picked up by others or helped by others, or they'll push something over the edge that's been in this sort of general mood of the community already. So I think they have a lot of influence still. Others argue that they have less than I think they have, but I think it would be dangerous for us to dismiss the amount of impact that they still have.
And David, you might just have seen an example of it recently in post the federal budget being handed down in May.
All right. Now, look, there's an issue you raise in the book that troubles me a great deal. Mm-hmm. You seem to be arguing for some kind of legislative break on the Murdoch empire and its strategies and ambitions. What kind of legislative regime do you have in mind?
Well, I think actually what we're arguing is that that's been very difficult to accomplish in the past, and that the Murdoch press pushed back so vehemently against it that the odds of that happening realistically are pretty small.
Okay, but what is it that you can imagine protects free speech and makes a news empire, the most controversial of all things, fairer?
Well, it's a very difficult question. I don't think anyone has actually come up with a really strong answer. I agree with Andrew. More legislation doesn't seem to be the way it's going to happen. I mean, if with the phone hacking scandal in the United Kingdom back a decade or more ago, if significant legislative reform was not going to come of that completely egregious series of events, then, you know, what would prompt the media? And we know that it was not simply news that was involved in phone hacking, but they were the ones involved in it on an industrial scale. So there's a couple of things that need to be done. I mean, one of them at least is that we all, as the audience and the readers and so on, need to take some ownership and some agency of this as an issue, and to actually say, well, if we don't like what we're being given, object to it, don't buy it, move on. We also need, I think, to both nurture and to cherish the important national cultural institutions we have already that are providing other perspectives on the world. And I'm talking about the ABC, and I'm also talking about SBS. I mean, they are both important, and they are regularly attacked by news, as we've already talked about. They need to be... this is a kind of a worldwide issue too, the kind of attacks on public broadcasters, but news has been doing that for a long time, going right back to Rupert's father, Sir Keith Murdoch.
Yeah, Rupert's father in the 1930s compelled the ABC to take commercial news broadcasts rather than have a news channel, news services of its own. The war got rid of that. Hey, but Andrew, there is nothing better than competing voices, is there not, to deal with a media empire that you and Matthew don't like? I mean, you know, it's other voices. It's the ABC. It's Fairfax. It's but it's also, you know, these young people today go online and look at things. It's amazing. That's how you deal with it, isn't it?
You mean an actual genuine contest of ideas, which is what the Australian now purports to be. I couldn't agree more. That's absolutely what's needed. We need a truly pluralist media landscape. And, you know, your opening point about one person owning and controlling two-thirds of the Australian newspaper market is not healthy. That is not a pluralist market. And I often think that Australians don't know what we're missing. We don't know anymore what a pluralist media environment looks like, because it's been so dominated by one person for 40 years. And it's exactly what we need. As Matthew said, we do need to bolster our national broadcasters because they are an important countervailing voice. We're not saying News Corp should disappear. We're definitely not even saying that it should be regulated in ways that curtail its free speech. We're saying that we need a truly healthy media environment, and that means standing up to them as bullies, but also nurturing and protecting the rest of the Australian media.
I've been trying to nudge the pair of you to get to the high praise you give Media Watch. I mean, how obvious do I have to be before you get to this point?
Much more obvious than
that's
that. Because,
right.
But that's a good point, David, because it is sort of seen as a given that Media Watch exists, but Media Watch is one of the most important things in our Australian democracy in terms of keeping our media accountable.
There is and has been since 1989 when that program began, there has been a genuine culture of self-scrutiny within the ABC. I'm sure that some people within the ABC chafe about Media Watch. That's kind of the point. They do that. Now, if you look at the kind of the parallel voice in the Australian, its media section, very rarely do you see self-criticism and self-scrutiny in that. You see a lot of boostering of both Rupert Murdoch in particular and the company in general. Their readership and their audience always seems to be going up and up and up. And so that kind of culture, and it's not just in the Australian, as a company, News Corp has been both secretive and loath to engage in public self-scrutiny and self-criticism. And I think that is deeply corrosive, and that's the pair, if you like, to the thin skin and the bashing up of critics of them.
But, Andrew, isn't the sad fact that the diminution of the influence of the Murdoch press is just a sign of the worst possible thing that is coming, which is just the complete collapse of newspapers? They're pretty much soon going to be over.
Yeah, I think when Rupert goes, it'll be very interesting to see how quickly some mastheads in Australia are closed. I can't imagine that Lachlan has the same commitment that Rupert has to those mastheads. And I think as part of that, the general atomisation of the media, the fact that we don't have a town square anymore like we once did, where we get a concentration of voices in the right way. So we get people basically being able to come together and agree on what they disagree about and have civil conversations. We're now in our own little silos, we're atomised all over the place, and that is deeply concerning. So the point we make in the book is that as all of this was beginning to develop, News Corp had the opportunity to be a calming voice, for them to take a leadership role because of their legacy role and because of their impact on new media. They chose to squib that. They chose to go onto one side and start throwing rocks with the right rather than being that calming influence. And I think they missed a really important opportunity.
Matthew, we've got about a minute left.
Sure.
And I reckon we should give due praise to the Australian newspaper when it was first conceived and published, and its role in transforming serious journalism for the better in this country.
Very, very happy to do that. I mean, I worked on the paper in the 1980s, as you know, and I would agree with that. It has had some periods during its long history now where it has been a really good, strong national voice for debate and discussion. And I think one of the tragedies is that it's now a kind of a broadsheet newspaper primarily engaged in tabloid newspaper tactics. And that's to the diminution of the newspaper, in my view, and also to all of us who read it and engage with it.
And Andrew, would you agree with me that one thing tabloid newspapers can give us are headlines that are fabulously clever?
Yeah, it's funny. I have this debate with others, and I'm not really enamoured by pun-ridden headlines.
Not just puns. I mean, I think they're the source of the most astonishing public poetry a lot of the time.
Sometimes they are. That's true. Look, if you need me to agree with you on that, David, I will, just for the sake of civility.
Can I disagree with you on that, David?
Matthew, please.
All right. You're trying to nudge us towards talking about the famous New York Post headline, "Headless Body in Topless Bar."
It was pretty good.
Yeah, great headline. I would urge you and your listeners to go and track down the history of that headline, the kind of shenanigans that went on in the newsroom, both to twist the story so that they could run the headline, and then a squabble in the newsroom, you'll be surprised to hear that, about who would claim glory for it. And then go and look at the actual crime that was being described. It is gruesome and horrific, and it's almost entirely absent from both the headline and the story.
Was it a topless bar? Yes or no?
It was a topless
was
bar.
It a headless, was it a yes, headless body? Yes, yes or no?
Yes.
Thank you, Matthew, for your contribution.
But your worship.
No.
David, you're sounding like a barrister now.
Well, of course. I have legal training. I'm being given one of those gestures by the executive producer of Late Night Live, which indicates that it's well past time that we just shut up. I have been speaking to Andrew Dodd and Matthew Ricketson about their new book, Getting Murdoch'd, How Murdoch's Media Wields Power and Punishment. Up next, time to celebrate the epidemics that never were. After COVID, the world's more alert than ever to the wreckage epidemics can wreak. It's a long way away, but we're even keeping an eye on the Ebola outbreak in the Congo, which the World Health Organization has now declared a public health emergency of international concern. So this is the time for the good news that comes from the non-profit health group Resolve to Save Lives in their publication, The Epidemics That Didn't Happen, 2026. The report looks at how a range of outbreaks were stopped before they could grow into full-scale epidemics. Amanda McClellan is Chief Program Officer at Resolve to Save Lives, and she joins us on the show now. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Amanda, thanks so much, David.
Amanda, before we get going, what is happening in the Congo at the moment? How bad is this Ebola outbreak?
This Ebola outbreak's been going for about 5 weeks now, and we already have documented over 1,000 cases and almost 300 deaths. And we know that's an underestimate of what's currently happening. But this is almost the perfect storm for a large-scale outbreak. I think what's important to understand is this is in a remote part of the Democratic Republic of Congo that's been impacted for a long period of time by conflict. There's artisanal mining or non-sanctioned mining in the area, so there's a lot of population movement, a large amount of refugees in the area, very limited access for international partners and the government. And so health services were already very poor in the area. And it does look like we've missed the start of this outbreak by several weeks, if not months. And that's really important when we think about Ebola. Time matters, and the earlier we detect cases, the more we can stop outbreaks from spreading. And this is really what makes this outbreak looking like it's going to be almost our worst case scenario, is that the number of cases that were already happening by the time we declared the outbreak was almost 300, and that's very late. And so this outbreak is very big. We don't have it under control in terms of contact tracing and knowing where and the Ebola is transmitting, and so there's still a lot of work to happen before we start to reach the peak of this outbreak.
You were there for an outbreak in 2014, weren't you?
Yeah, I was in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, what we call the West Africa Ebola crisis. That crisis led to more than 11,000 deaths and took more than 2 years to get under control. We've learned a lot since then, and so I'm hopeful that this outbreak will be controlled before it hits those levels. But as I said, we're starting from behind the starting line, so to speak, and there's a lot of work we need to do to catch up with the outbreak. It's moving very fast.
What's the impact been of the United States essentially ending aid to the Congo?
Yeah, I think this has been a core question people have been asking, and it's hard to quantify. I think, you know, obviously the US has been the biggest deliverer of overseas development assistance, and especially in this type of scenario, this long-term humanitarian crisis. But there's other actors in the space, the Doctors Without Borders and the Red Cross and others who weren't reliant on US government funding, but obviously it doesn't help. This is a highly neglected area, a very vulnerable population, and so any withdrawal of fund or services increase the risk. We have seen the US government step up and make some large donations and provide support. But it, you know, the system has broken apart. It was very disruptive the last 12 months. And so the sector as a whole is trying to respond to this outbreak while we're still trying to rebuild the connections and the networks, the collaborations that have been impacted by the US withdrawal from the World Health Organization and reduction in funding.
But Amanda, we promised some good news, and let's turn to your 2026 report about the epidemics that didn't happen. Why do you think it's important that this be documented?
Yeah, for that exact reason, as you said, when I came out of West Africa Ebola, the sector as a whole, you know, we really realized that people only know about epidemics and public health when there's these large outbreaks, the Ebola outbreak, the COVID outbreak, even the recent Hunter virus outbreak on the cruise ship. Public health is only visible when these big outbreaks get out of control. But it was important that we show the invisible work that happens every day, that public health teams are finding outbreaks every day and stopping them from becoming large events. That the preparedness system is working and is worth investing in full time. Sometimes this preparedness work, we talk about the invisible pandemic paradox, that no one cares about it when it's not there. I think everyone's, you know, keen to forget about what happened with COVID and move on, but those risks remain. And there's people every day working to make sure that that doesn't happen again. And so this report helps make that visible and shine a light on the amazing work that people are doing every day.
Explain to me the 717 target.
Yeah, this is a target that we really developed on at the end of Ebola for a few reasons. And it is exactly what I explained with the Ebola outbreak. Time matters. And the faster we find these outbreaks, the easier they are to control. The more lives we save and the costs are reduced. And so we created a target that we call the 717 target. 7 days to detect an outbreak, 1 day to notify that outbreak, and 7 days to start the major response components. And this target gives us a common language and a common benchmark to use across countries and across diseases to really understand how the system's performing, and allows us to identify the things that are slowing us down so that we can prioritize those to improve. And so we've been working with this target alongside the World Health Organization and the US government, the World Bank and others, and now more than 90 countries are implementing this as a benchmark or a standard of care that really helps us better improve the detection and response capacity in countries.
Now, one of the case studies you've got here is what was done when malaria loomed in El Salvador. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, it wasn't us. We were showcasing the government counterparts there, but it was a really great example of understanding the risk and being proactive. So they understood that they were getting a large number of workers that had been in the Democratic Republic of Congo actually coming back to El Salvador, and there was a risk that they would bring malaria with them. And El Salvador had worked hard to eliminate malaria from the country. And so they understood the risk that that posed, and they set up surveillance systems before those travelers returned. They made sure that they had the right equipment, lab tests, medication to be able to deal with any cases. And I think one of the really great innovations is as they started to get cases, they really looked at how they could control the risk. And so they moved those patients to a hospital higher up in the mountains where the mosquito that transmits malaria isn't able to survive. And so essentially reduced the risk of transmission locally in El Salvador to zero. So it was a really fantastic example of understanding the risks, being proactive, finding cases quickly, and then using the resources that you have to try to limit any risk of transmission to the rest of the population.
And working simultaneously to deal with those who are infected and to stop the mosquitoes getting the bug into their systems. And you've got to do it at the same time.
Exactly, yeah. So the worst case scenario is that mosquitoes bite patients that have malaria while they're sick, and then they're infected and they are able to go and bite other people and start local transmission. And that's really what they were trying to limit while providing good quality care for those people that had returned with malaria. And so they were extremely successful and didn't get any local transmission and were able to continue to become be malaria free.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I am talking to Amanda McClellan, who's the Chief Program Officer of Resolve to Save Lives, a group that works to prevent epidemics. Amanda, anticipating an epidemic, knowing that there is a looming danger, how is that done?
We do it in a few different ways. The first one is to really understand the country context you're in and what the historical disease patterns are. So what are we looking for in terms of some areas have regular cholera outbreaks, malaria, dengue. These are all impacted by geography and historical disease burden that is there. And so understanding when and how they transmit. So cholera is often seasonal after heavy rains, and so we can increase surveillance systems and increase prevention activities when we know there's been heavy rains, for example. Things like the El Nino system that are coming through in the next few weeks, we know that that changes the disease burden, especially in East Africa, causes droughts and floods, and we know the disease patterns that come from that. And so we're already getting ready with surveillance systems to be able to detect that. But then there's these novel events that are harder to prepare for, the rare events that are high impact, like the Ebolas, like the recent Hunter virus, or a similar outbreak in Rwanda called Marburg that happened a few months ago. These are rare events, and they come from wildlife and spill over into the human population. And these are a challenge to find quickly. And so what's really important there is a strong community-based surveillance system and strong primary health care. So one of the things that we actively work on is training frontline nurses and healthcare workers to have what we call an increased clinical suspicion. They need to find that one case that just doesn't look right, and they need to make sure that they call someone for help, that they wear the right protective equipment, and they care for that patient till they can get appropriate lab tests. And so it can be very challenging for these novel events like Ebola to find those first cases. But it's really about strengthening those frontline health systems and surveillance work.
And suspicion, I like that. Tell us about the Mpox that loomed in Gabon.
Mpox was declared a global emergency. It was spreading quickly across the world. This was also
what
an
is
interesting
it, Amanda?
Case of Mpox is a disease that spreads from human to human contact, and we had a large outbreak about 18 months ago that spread globally, mainly through sexual contact, and it was moving through Europe as well as North America. But in Africa, it affected pediatric populations and women and children. And Gabon did a great job of increasing their preparedness at the primary healthcare level and really increasing their clinical suspicion and finding every case, educating the community through radio and through community health workers, and we're really able to stop local transmission in Gabon very quickly.
And was that by the application of 717?
Yes, they used the 717 metric for each outbreak and then understood where and how they needed to improve the system to get faster. And so they were able to increase their surveillance and detection times, as well as their immediate response times, hitting the 717 target regularly.
Are sexually transmitted epidemics particularly hard to deal with?
Yes, they can be. Obviously, there's a stigma involved with sexually transmitted diseases. Obviously, there's often vulnerable groups like men who have sex with men who often aren't very visible to the healthcare system or don't trust the healthcare system, and so often don't present to health facilities. But in some sectors, it's also the group that mobilizes very quickly. And we did see that through Mpox, the men who have sex with men community really mobilized very quickly and did a fantastic job of making sure that people knew about the vaccine and set up community-based systems to be able to access their community and really increase vaccination rates. And so we saw that outbreak controlled, especially in North America and Europe, very, very quickly because of that local community organization.
You said a moment ago about the invisibility of your successes. When an epidemic doesn't happen, it isn't news. But do the authorities understand this, that an achievement is a kind of, a great achievement can be a kind of absolute negative? There's nothing there, boom, boom, but that's a great achievement. Do authorities understand that?
Not always. It's one of our biggest challenges, but it is also one of the reasons that 717 works very well, because it allows us to count to zero for the first time. We're able to show political leaders the near misses that the system is finding and controlling in an easy to understand language that's reportable. And so this has been one of the biggest benefits of 717. It's really made the invisible work visible, and we're able to show the near misses regularly and consistently that keeps the investment going into the system. But yeah, it's difficult to keep the prioritization on surveillance systems when diseases haven't happened for many years. I think there's a case in the United States at the moment of screwworm in the animal, in the cattle industry. And this had been eliminated from the country for 65 years. And slowly over the last 5 to 6 years, funding for that surveillance system and prevention of that disease had been taken away and eroded, to the point where the surveillance systems and prevention were now non-existent. It used to cost $300 million a year to keep that surveillance system in place. They're now going to spend $1 billion trying to eradicate that disease in the next 2 years. So the cost of not investing in preparedness can be significant.
You also write about the cycle of panic and abandonment. What do you mean by that?
It's what we were just discussing. Essentially, during COVID, there was a lot of money flowing into the sector, both from government and philanthropy, to strengthen the systems to control the outbreak. But we almost see a swing away from that at the end of COVID, where money is reprioritized and taken away from health, taken away from public health systems. And then we get outbreaks like Ebola, and we see another surge of support. And so it's these waves of investment, this investing during the panic, even for something far away like Ebola, we see a flood of new resources coming into public health.
Yes.
And as soon as that visible threat goes away, so does the money.
Yep. Well, that the epidemics that didn't happen 2026 is designed to contest exactly that habit. And Amanda, is it available online? Can people just go online and read it?
Yes, it's a digital report. You'll be able to find it online under Epidemics That Didn't Happen or the Resolve to Save Lives website.
Amanda, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Yeah, thank you so much, David.
I've been talking to Amanda McClelland, who's the Chief Program Officer, Resolve to Save Lives, a group that works to prevent epidemics and to keep the danger of epidemics alive in the public imagination. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show and the week, which means it's time for Chatterbox. We've had a lot to say about the deadly habits of mosquitoes lately on this show and last week when I spoke to Gordana Rasic of Queensland University of Technology about using AI to wipe them out. That wasn't how it was done when Christina Sobey was with the New South Wales Health Commission in Albury in the 1970s as they tried to head off an upsurge in Murray Valley encephalitis by finding where the mosquitoes were lurking in winter. To this end, she wrote to us the other day, to this end a tinny was bought for the health inspectors and off they went, sometimes for days at a time, slowly motoring down the river, searching every backwater and reed-choked bend. Those trips were relished, a chance to be out on the river, trawling a line behind the tinny, stopping overnight in small river towns for a meal, a beer and a bed, then back to the serious business of tracking down those bloody mozzies, as they were universally known. Thanks, Christina. And my thanks, as always, to the team. Producers Ali Benton, Catherine Zengerer and Anne Arnold, and executive producer Jack Schmidt. Until next week.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.